Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! A minute past the hour on this, the 11th day of July, 2013, and thus we begin Thorn in the Side Thursday on the Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. The Horn is, we like to think it's a fairly unique little undertaking, a fairly unique little enterprise. It's not really an enterprise, really. It is an effort. It is an effort to create community on the internet-based airwaves, where the conversation can be free-form, invigorating, intelligent, and enlightened. That's the goal. Sometimes I myself fail at it, sputtering and losing my little grip I have on the last remaining vestiges of my sanity, but that is the goal. How does it happen? It happens because of you. It happens because of you. It happens when you contribute your ideas and when you contribute your funds to keep it going. We try to raise $150 a night, and we ended the program last night at a deficit, but that deficit was resolved over the course of the day today, so that it's actually, it feels a little bit like it's ahead of the game, insofar as we've only got to raise $300, $150 tonight, $150 tomorrow, to finish the week's goal to the good. So thank you very, very much. Thanks to Horst, and I will check with the other contributor to make sure to see whether or not I can tell you who that person was as well. But the backlog was sorted, and that was a very good thing, because today I paid, the internet bill. Oh, mercy. And the phone bill. Oh, mercy. Yeah, that hurt. It didn't hurt. It's just what we have to do. So, there you have it. Thank you. Thank you indeed. So, yeah, 30 people, 10 bucks. 15 people a night, 10 bucks. Hopefully, we can get there and find ourselves moving toward the middle of July in good shape for creating in August. I wanted to share a note with you that I received. This note came from Ron, and he explains why it is, and we will get to the thorns of Thorn in the Side Thursday in quite possibly shorter order than you may wind up wishing we had. Ron wrote from Arizona. And he said, greetings from Arizona, Bob. Aren't I observant? Yes. Greetings from Arizona, Bob. I was listening to your podcast the other day, and I heard you mention the donation from No Last Name over the weekend. I just wanted to introduce myself and explain why I donated under the name No Last Name. And when I saw this, I immediately continued reading, because it was quite intriguing. I don't think we've ever had a contribution from No Last Name. We've had contributions from Please Don't Use My Name, contributions from No Name Needed. I'm not sure. I don't think we've ever had a contribution from Post No Bills or Use No Hooks or This Side Up. But No Last Name, it caught my eye immediately. And what this note tells us is about all the people that are out there who are, whether you hear them on this program or not, or whether they ever even write an email, a vital part of this community. So, yes, I donated under the name No Last Name. I live in Arizona and have listened to your podcasts for quite a few years now. Living in Arizona, I probably don't have to explain to you that we have a general lack of progressive talk radio. We have one station, which doesn't work unless you're outside with a radio that has an antenna and there are no clouds in the sky. Yes, our liberal station is just horrible with its reception. You'll notice I put the term liberal in quotes, and the reason for that is that it turns out our liberal station has decided to start playing advertisements for Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity. Remember, we refer to Sean as the life support system for a haircut, or perhaps Brill Cream's best friend, in between Stephanie Miller and Tom Hartman's programs. Oh, they've also decided to banish Mike Malloy to a two-hour slot starting at 12 midnight so that they may play the Fox News broadcast of the Alan Colmes show. No, really. Full Fox commercials and everything. Why, this herbal formulation will grow hair on your bowling ball, and it won't come off even if you drop it on a Swedish mattress. But you can pick it up with this vacuum cleaner. Great. Needless to say, Ron continues, that with our winning lineup for our liberal station, I was surprised and frankly happy to come across something like the Horn and White Rose Society. I was quite surprised and taken aback at the lineup of free podcasts it offered, and that is where I came across your program. I've been listening to podcasts for the past few years, mainly putting them into my MP3 player and listening in between classes at Arizona State University and my local community college. Due to our lack of a competent liberal station out here, see above, I found myself listening to your podcasts almost daily for a while, and in that time really wanted to donate to the Horn. However, going through college on essentially savings bonds left me without a whole lot of pocket change to use on the side for a few years, I just found myself listening more than anything else. I've graduated now, magna cum laude at Arizona State University. Magna cum laude? Pardon me. Big golf clap for magna cum laude. With both my associate and bachelor in computer science, and I'm finally working full-time. Which brings me to my puzzling donation. I'm a rather unfriendly person to the world of online shopping, believe it or not, but a computer person like me actually prefers going to the store more than doing all of my purchases online, and as such, I've never been a fan of putting my personal credit card information on the Internet. Instead, when I do make a purchase online, I use Visa throwaway debit cards, which are essentially disposable gift cards named A Gift for You. This makes online shopping a bit awkward at times, as I can't use my actual name with the purchase because if I enter anything aside from A Gift for You, the card will not work. I've tried it in the past. These disposable gift cards are also not friendly to using last names, so these will also cause the payment transactions to not go through. Thus, I entered my name, no last name, when I made my donation. Though I realized my donation was small, no it wasn't, there's no such thing, and it wasn't small, I will contribute more in the future when I'm able. Now that I'm working full-time, I'd like to try and repay the Horn for the hundreds of hours of free entertainment it's provided me. So expect more donations from A Gift for You, No Last Name. We will keep a weather eye out. If you read any of my emails on air, you'll note that I prefer that you call me Ron. Well, I'm sure I don't have to tell you that Arizona isn't the most liberal-friendly place. Liberal-friendly? There are like little pockets, but mostly you have to sort in serpentine from one to the other, right? I also happen to work for a bunch of right-wingers who are completely fair and balanced, if you catch my drift. HK, your IFDRE. Absolutely. Oxfay. Whose name?
Mm-hmm.
The same people who can also talk for hours about how ain't no way a gun be used for killerin' folks on account of they ain't weapons, them's be tools. Ron writes very well in the idiom. It's obvious that he's dealing with the genuine article. That's precious. Ain't no way a gun be used for killerin' folks on account they ain't weapons, them's be tools. Why, that sounds like authentic frontier gibberish. Yeah. Though I realize people like this will never listen to liberal radio, I'd still rather you just use the name Ron for my contributions. Just makes life simpler living in this red state, so long as no one mistakes me for that dumbass Ron Paul. Anyway, Bob, I've always enjoyed the program, and for what it's worth, I've attempted to spread you around to a few other people out here in Arizona. Well, there's a lot of me, and it'll be a while before I start spreading thin. But, of course, Arizona being such a red state, I'm only able to spread the horn so much out here. You know how that is. Oh, I do. Believe me, I do. Trust me, in a state like West Virginia, I do not wear a T-shirt around that says, "Hi, I'm Bob. I do liberal radio." A few people know, but for most, I'm just that mild-mannered guy who slips down to the Rippy Mart for the occasional bottle of iced tea. Please, no emails about me buying iced tea. Regardless, says Ron, I will try to contribute some more in the future. Please keep the conversation going. We will, Ron, and we thank you very, very much. And, you know, I just get this mental image of someone working his way through college and paying attention to classes. You know, we're talking about Arizona State University, one of, if not the largest university in the United States, and they're not exactly handing out magna cum laudes in gumball machines. It's not like that University of Phoenix affair where, you know, you can hit a degree on the back of a matchbook as long as you can draw Spunky the Turtle, or is that McConnell the Turtle, and, you know, the pirate Rand Paul. Yar! No. But I love having the image that over the course of years and Ron's academic work, he's been walking around that, and it's a beautiful campus, I'm telling you, walking around, you know, headphones, earbuds, whatever, perhaps muttering, "Bastards," or maybe laughing even, or shaking his head or whatever. It's in the same vein as our buddy Dennis in Kentucky, with whom for several years now, I've been mowing grass. I love the smell of fresh cut grass. Lawn grass, damn it! Stop it. And Dennis and I have been mowing for a number of years, there's a lot of podcast listeners out there, and the more you share your stories, the more the rest of us feel like, yeah, it really is a bigger community than what we even really understand. So thank you, Ron, no last name, for the help you did extend. It was badly needed, and it has been a significant help toward keeping all of this going. And like I said, people offer different takes on why they join in on keeping this going. I had a note from Philip. I'd sent him a thank you, and he wrote back and said, "It's reciprocity in action. You sacrifice time with your wife and family to spend with us so many evenings and create a community over the airwaves. They graciously permit it, and we are the lucky recipients of their tolerance and largesse. Being part of that community, I have a responsibility to help as much as I can. Given a decision between ordering two pizzas or helping the horn in a small way, the choice is not difficult. And I would add, it's downright easy if you think about pizza outlets like Domino's, run by a right-winger, or Papa John's, run by a right-winger, or, and I remember the story from a long way back, Pizza Hut, for instance, where the shredded mozzarella that arrives to them in bags is actually sprayed with silicone. No kidding. And no evidence out there to suggest that it's food grade or that people really ought to be eating it, but it keeps it from clumping in the bag. wonder what it does in your gut. Pizza Hut, brought to you by Yum Brands. That word, I don't think they know what it means. But, so yeah, so Philip continues and says, there's also an ethical issue at stake. My wife is adamant that I need new underwear. I have no problem wearing t-shirts with holes and old boxers because no one outside of the home sees them, and new ones will just get worn out eventually anyways. Well, that's downright nihilistic, Philip. Besides, the greatest basketball player ever, Bill Russell, was never... I want you to follow the logic here. I mean, this is unassailable reason. This is... I would never want to be in an argument with Philip because I would wind up just a quivering lump in the corner, curled up into a fetal position, sucking my thumb. Listen to this reasoning. Besides, the greatest basketball player ever, Bill Russell, was never honored with any underwear commercials a la Air and Air, that's A-A-R and H-E-I-R, Jordan. So it's my duty, as a Boston Celtics fan, to ignore my wife's protests and use the underwear allowance more wisely. Let's just say that funds she'd rather see allocated for underwear instead underwrite in a small way the horn. In the meantime, I exhort my t-shirts and shorts to live according to the words of Buddy Holly and not fade away. As for my wife, she'll get used to being shorts changed or unchanged, so to speak, to benefit the horn. This came in on Tuesday. Philip said, it's almost Wednesday, Bob, and I'd rather donate religiously and be holy, H-O-L-E-L-Y, than feign holiness by donating to religion. I think that's enough terrible punning for one missive, so I'll end here. And, yes, you don't want to court the goddess of punnery any more than absolutely necessary. So thank you. Thank you, Philip. Ah, okay, this coming in from Cassie at Princeton. Ron is not the only one, Cassie says. I also have no last name. Fully intend to graduate with honors and listen to the Horn and Molloy podcasts, walking or cycling all over campus. She means she does that now. It's not that she intends to later. She fully intends to graduate with honors, and she will. And yes, whether it be the sunny, warm campus of Arizona State, or the Ivy, are they Ivy bedecked, Cassie? I don't know. Ivy bedecked halls of the alma mater of James Madison and Aaron Burr, Princeton. Just think about it. People walking around with their MP3 players on, their earbuds in. I mean, I see them in Washington, D.C. all the time, and I wonder if they're listening to the horn. You know, the odds are probably that they aren't. But at any given time, standing outside the Horn headquarters there on Constitution Avenue, I probably see 100 people in an hour running along with their podcast going on. And you never know. You never know where the next Horn listener might be lurking. So before we jump into the depths of Thorn in the Side Thursday, I wanted to share that with you just because it provides a sense of closeness and, yes, of community. Okay, thank you, Cassie. Yes, lots of ivy and cobblestone. But the bike paths are well paved. Yeah, because biking over cobblestone can suck a little bit, right? So, Thorn in the Side Thursday. A couple of stories rising out of the fetid swamp that is the House of Representatives today. And yea, verily, weird they are. It's one of those cases the story, what it does is it effectively puts paid to the phony baloney decorum that these goobs of the Republican Party try to hide behind. Two incidents. Both from today. Our buddy the Angry Indian put me onto one of them, and Texas Betsy alerted me to the other. It must have been a rather highly charged day over in the junior house of the Congress. Both stories center on a piece of dastardly business going on in the House. Now, you may recall that we were none of us were any too gentle with the Democrats in the Senate, who crafted a farm bill that left crop subsidies and insurance for farmers in place. You remember that one member of Congress from Tennessee who just sits around and once a year makes the long walk to the mailbox and gets a check for $70,000 just because and it's not his pay from the Congress, it's his pay for being a farmer feeding America. And he just, once a year he has to take that long walk to the mailbox and pick up that $60,000 or $70,000 check that he gets just for being him. Because he's that special. On the other hand, the Senate bill did cut out about $4 billion of the food stamp budget because, well, hungry people, F them, right? We really are fast approaching just living the script for Idiocracy, one of the patron saint films of the Horn. You may recall the motto of Carl's Jr. in Idiocracy. Come back when you have some money. Carl's Jr., F you, I'm eating. And you may recall the cabinet secretary who, every time he says anything, prefaces what he says by saying, brought to you by Carl's Jr., until at one point, Not Sure looks at him, this is before he becomes president, Not Sure, and says, why do you keep saying this? Because they pay me every time I say it. It's cool. Brought to you by Carl's Jr. Well, the Republican Party has, I don't know, maybe they're all getting checks from Carl's Jr. Maybe they're drinking Brondo. You know, it's got electrolytes. It's what plants crave. Because that's what they said today. Hey, poor people, F you, we're eating. There were a pair of transactions. I want to go to this one first. It's a little bit lengthy, and it seems on its face to be rather mundane, as much business, ordinary business inside the House of Representatives can be. Anyone who's ever tuned in to Prime Minister's Question Time on the Beeb knows that that can be a rollicking and zany affair. And many of us kind of wish ours could be as well, that maybe if people were a little more honest in the room, but you get the idea. And compared with a particularly confrontational episode of Prime Minister's Question Time, well, House proceedings can seem downright dull until one comprehends what lies underneath. Take, for instance, the attempt by several members of the House of Representatives who happen to be Democrats to do something as mundane, and usually the guy with the gavel who's standing in for, say, Boehner, they'll say, I reserve the right to supplement my remarks in the record by writing, and whoever it is that's periodically whacking himself in the head with the gavel, just trying to keep awake, says, Without objection, so ordered. Whack. That's what this should be. So what the House of Representatives is doing, and more particularly the Repig-Lickin' majority, who are trying to, apart from the overarching, larger, general project of simply trying to dismantle a government which they now unabashedly despise, you know, from Valley Forge forward, unless, of course, they can use it to advance America's God-given rights to own guns. Well, they really—I mean, it really has, despite the BS facade of collegiality or courtesy that prevails, it really has become Lord of the Flies in there. I fully expect that one of these days, Steve Stockman or Steve King or any one of these goobers is just going to run across the aisle and start gnawing at the arm of a Democrat and shrieking unintelligible words about freedom, freedom, Marines, freedom, freedom, and free market, free market. I don't know. Yeah, I had her arm with some fava beans and a nice old Milwaukee. Right? So it seems kind of mundane, but what they did is the House is fascinated with its own prerogatives and wants nothing to do with the Senate's version of the Farm Bill that has already effed a couple of million people out of food. And was done so with the connivance of a whole boatload of Democrats. But the Republicans in the House have something to prove. Even though the Democrats were willing to F a bunch of poor people, the Republicans didn't think that enough poor people had been F'd. And they wanted to teach us all how it's done. So instead of passing an omnibus farm bill, they got this novel idea that they would strip the food stamp program, otherwise known as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, out of the farm bill and kill it separately. You know, so they could pass the farm bill that would then make sure that that gentleman planter from Tennessee could continue to make the long walk down to his mailbox for his $70,000 check just for being him. This idea did not sit well with people who actually give a rat's rear end about the ability of an entire segment of the American population to go on being food eaters. Because being food eaters is intimately associated with them being able to go on being water drinkers and air breathers, and not a member of that subclass generally referred to as the dead. And no, not the band. And so it was, with plans in the offing to split the idea that working people of low wages and people of no wages might still be just American enough to deserve to eat food, Democrats tried to register their objections in that format in which I said most usually the fill-in speaker is sitting there in the chair and, Mr. Speaker, I reserve the right to supplement my remarks in the record. Without objection, so ordered. Well, no snoring today.
Here.
The gentleman from Massachusetts is recognized.
I yield to the gentlelady from Oregon, Ms. Wanamichi, for a unanimous consent request.
The gentlelady is recognized.
Mr. Speaker, I ask unanimous consent to revise and extend my remarks in strong opposition to the Farm Bill rule and the underlying bill because it will increase hunger in America.
She's a real firebrand, that Representative Bonamici from Oregon, isn't she? I mean, you can just hear the fury and you can feel the hot breath of her of her dragon lady nature on the back of your neck as she says that, can't you? No, you can't. Because if it would be, and then you know the rest of the procedure.
Mr. Speaker, I ask unanimous consent.
The Speaker will ask, and then he goes back to sleep.
Consent to revise and extend my remarks in strong opposition to the Farm Bill rule and the underlying bill because it will increase hunger in America.
Objection. There is objection.
Well, son of a gun. I guess whoever it was that was doing all of his objectifying must have maybe somehow objected to the way that the gentle lady from Oregon was dressed. Or maybe she spoke in a tone too high-pitched for him to hear. Or maybe she was wearing far too sensible shoes. Or maybe her haircut just didn't sit with him. I mean, surely to goodness, in something as routine as this, it's just a one-off. Right? It was just her. That was just Representative Bonamici. I mean, these things happen, right?
Mr. Speaker, I yield to the... My good friend, the gentleman from Massachusetts, Mr. Kennedy, for a unanimous consent request.
Gentleman's recognized.
Thank you.
Okay. This is freshman Joe Kennedy from Massachusetts. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I ask unanimous consent to revise and extend my remarks in strong opposition to the Farm Bill rule and the underlying bill because it takes food nutrition away from working families.
Okay, that's sound. Pretty much pro forma. And after all, it's just a matter of making sure that you are making a record. This goes into the formal record of the proceedings of the House of Representatives, so that 1,000 years from now, somebody can go back and read that and understand what was really going on. I guess technically this is off the record until the Speaker rises from his slumber and says without objection, right?
Thank you.
Is there objection? There is objection.
Okay, that was because Joe Kennedy has really, really read it. And he's a freshman. I mean, he's hardly been in office for 7 months. Maybe somebody objected because they felt like he was not in his place by speaking. Or maybe he was speaking out of turn. Sure. I mean, there's got to be a reason, right?
Gentleman from Massachusetts will state his point of parliamentary.
Okay, so this is Representative Jim McGovern of Massachusetts, and in light of the fact that this is a procedure whereby usually the Speaker rises from his slumber without objection, whack, pro forma, as noted, de rigueur. And Representative Jim McGovern is not a freshman. He has been in the House of Representatives for quite some time and doing an able job as a progressive sent there by the people of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Well, just like an ant. I mean, are they doing it with their shoelaces done the wrong way? I mean, is it loop, swoop, and pull day in the Republican House of Representatives? And everybody's got bunny ears? I mean, what?
Am I understanding the gentleman's objection correctly that what he is doing is not even giving members on our side the courtesy of inserting their statement in the record?
Well, state a proper point of parliamentary inquiry.
I'm trying to understand.
Oh, he didn't state a proper point of parliamentary inquiry. Maybe if Jim McGovern got a good head of steam up and took a running leap at the speaker's podium and sort of grabbed at the speaker's throat yelling, "What the f*** is going on here? What in the wide, wide world of sports is going on here?" No, that probably wouldn't be parliamentary according to Hoyle or Marcus of Queensberry rules or whatever. No. Well, okay.
Then with the objection means that the gentleman from Texas, I mean, does that mean...
Oh, dear. Not the gentleman from Texas. I mean, there's a lot of gentlemen from Texas, right? A whole bunch of them. But I think we know who we're talking about, don't we? It's a farm bill, isn't it? Is there anything in this farm bill about asparagus? But see, again, this has to do with this being a Congress that is run by a majority which does not wish for the Congress to do the job that is set out for it in the Constitution of the United States, because they don't much like the Constitution of the United States and would far prefer the one drafted by the old Confederacy. Yeah. So they just make it up as they go on. No, he doesn't need to explain his objection. He gets to object whether it did. Maybe he just doesn't like you.
That the gentleman from Massachusetts' statement that he just made will not appear in the record?
The objection was to the unanimous consent request. The gentleman has not stated a point of parliamentary inquiry.
You know, I remember when I was just a youngin' being involved in an organization that went to great lengths to teach us Robert's Rules of Order. And who is this smirking prick in the speaker's chair? He's not stated a proper rule of parliamentary... Time out. I need a drink. Has not stated a proper parliamentary inquiry. You're not using the right magic words.
Mr. Speaker, at this point I'd like to yield to the gentlelady from New York, my good friend Ms. Lowy, for a unanimous consent request.
The gentlelady from New York is recognized.
Mr. Speaker, I ask unanimous consent to revise and extend my remarks in strong opposition to the Farm Bill rule and the underlying bill because it hurts the working poor and takes food and nutrition from hardworking families.
Because it does.
There's objection.
Well, son of a gun, there's objection.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to yield to the gentlelady from Nevada, Ms. Titus, for a unanimous consent request.
The gentlelady from Nevada is recognized.
Mr. Speaker, I ask unanimous consent to revise and extend my remarks in strong opposition to the Farm Bill rule and the underlying bill because it takes the safety net away from America and Nevada's poor families.
Is there objection? Without objection, so ordered.
Mr. Speaker, at this time, I think...
What? Well, see, she had a kind of a gooey accent, the gentle lady from Nevada, and so it's all right. Well, that or somebody had a mouthful of asparagus or something. Who knows? Mercy. All right, let's see if maybe we've experienced a little change of heart here.
Yield to the General Lady from the District of Columbia, Ms. Norton, for a unanimous consent request.
General Lady is recognized.
Mr. Speaker, I ask unanimous consent to revise and extend my remarks in strong opposition to the Farm Bill and the underlying rule because it increases hunger and poverty in America.
Is there objection? There is objection.
Oh, okay. There's an objection now because the brown lady spoke. The lady who represents Chocolate City. Good God.
Mr. Speaker, I yield myself 15 seconds.
The gentleman from Massachusetts is recognized for 15 seconds.
Yeah, I think it is extremely unfortunate that members on the other side of the aisle would deny members on this side of the aisle the ability to insert written materials in the record. In all my years here, I've never seen such
a
discourteous gesture.
Will the gentleman yield?
I will not yield to the gentleman.
The gentleman does not yield. The gentleman from Massachusetts reserves. The gentleman from Texas.
Oh, so that's what it was. Louis wanted the spotlight. Louis wanted to suck up the time. Louis Gohmert. Pile! I will be dipped. And bless his heart, Jim McGovern, after having had several members of the Democratic caucus subjected to a level of uncollegiality unlike anything he notes in recorded memory, and Mr. McGovern's been there a while, just said no. Well, the gentleman yelled. And see, this is where I'm at sixes and sevens. Because the phony civility that obtains in the House is nothing if not like unto a paid sex worker's kiss. It is transactional at best and fraudulent and possibly deleterious at worst. I could never sit in such a body because they'd get to work throwing me out after the first day. Will the gentleman yield? Why don't you sit down and shut the up, you ignorant barbarian? Go eat your asparagus. Because you know what would have happened. Because we ran the clip on this program, but days ago. Louis would have arisen to tell his crab leg story about the poor hard working Texans in his district who come to him a saying, Louis, I was standing down there at the HEB and I was standing in line behind somebody paying with their welfare money, and they had a whole grocery cart just chock full of them crab leggies. I ain't had no crab leggies in I don't know how long because I'm a working too hard and I can't afford no crab leggies. And I don't understand how somebody can be a deadbeat like one of them welfare trash and have a whole grocery cart full of them crab leggies. I want me some crab leggies, Louie, or if I can't have them, I don't want them having them. And then Louie'd have to tear up and sing a couple of choruses and Nearer My God to Thee, and I don't know, get out his pistol shooting gun and make sure he still had his freedom. In moments like this, we understand, do we not? We understand what it really means to be a failed state. Or at the very least, to be on the road to becoming one. And it's kind of tough, isn't it? It's kind of tough to be living in 2013 and having been raised as patriotic as the next person, to love one's country, pro patria, you know, and to have to just sort of step back and say, well, that's all, folks. The barbarians are no longer at the gates. The barbarians have gotten inside the gates, and they are looting Troy, and they are hammering at the walls so that we may never be protected against them ever again. They do not just despise our government. They seek to overthrow it. They seek to destroy it. And having destroyed it, to do what the Romans did to Carthage, to plow under its fields and salt the earth so that nothing may ever again live or survive there. This, by the way, is what a cold civil war looks and sounds like. Now, I got to say something here. It's only going to sound like this live, or it won't. It's going to be kind of weird on the podcast. I'm going to take a break because everything that I've just said never went out. Apparently, we are having difficulties reaching the server, and I'm going to pause up everything and see if we can get it fixed. This is the horn. We'll be back. Well, hallelujah. We're back. Ben Birch must have done his magic to make the servers behave again. And we're live. It probably felt like no time whatsoever if you're listening on the podcast. But if you're listening live, well, it's been a while. But let's try to pick up where we left off, shall we? When last we spoke, we were dealing with a gang of what's appropriate? Thugs, bandits, vandals, Visigoths, Franks, Huns, the Republican horde. Look, this is proof that they really don't care much for the Constitution, because the First Amendment is part of the Constitution. And using this kind of procedural chicanery to simply keep Democrats from expressing what exactly was going to happen, yeah, you don't care much about the Constitution if you do something like this. And by the way, the debate that this was all about, the vote went down. The final tally, 216-208. Which means some Republicans voted against this chicanery as well. By a vote of 216-208, the Republican Congress, the Lord of the Flies Congress, approved a farm bill that did not contain funding or perhaps any reference to the SNAP program. Not a sausage, not a nickel, not a thin dime, not a penny. And it was the fact that the Republicans were being called out for, in fact, working to make babies' bellies rumble in the night. They tried to stifle dissent because they are totalitarians and they cannot therefore tolerate dissent. Before the vote was taken, one last brave individual tried to exercise some modicum of free speech inside the dictatorial House of Representatives. Go back. As far as you care to, you will not find Democrats at a time when they were running the House of Representatives doing this to Republicans. You won't find it. But let us now praise strong women. In this case, Florida's Corinne Brown. Who merely wanted to point out what a moral and ethical travesty was taking place.
Thank you. Mr. Speaker, the Bible says, to whom much is given, much is respect. Much is required.
Now wait a minute. We're starting with a Bible verse, Representative Brown. You're gonna read the Bible to the Republican Party, Representative Brown. You have my respect, but the Republican Party only thumps the Bible. They don't read it, okay? But still, let's see what the lesson is.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Welcome.
The Bible says, to whom much is given, much is respect. Much is required. This is a sad day in the House of Representatives. Shame on the Republicans. Shame on the House of Representatives.
Uh-oh. She said shame on the Republicans. A woman of dark skin said shame on the Republicans. This is going to be trouble.
suspend.
The gentle lady will suspend. That's because a pissant by the name of Representant Rob Woodall, a Republican from Georgia, and nobody knows quite like a white member of the House of Representatives from Georgia how to make a woman of color be quiet. Surprised they didn't say the Negress shall suspend. Yeah.
Suspend. The gentlelady will be seated.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This is a...
No, the gentle...
wait. What?
Suspend. The gentlelady will be seated.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This is a...
No, the gentlelady will suspend.
The Negress will be quiet.
Gentlelady will be seated.
Oh, pasty face man, I don't think you know what you're doing. Because bless her heart, Representative Corinne Brown did not sit down. A white man just told a black woman to go sit down and shut up.
Excuse me? What did I say that was incorrect?
Shall suspend. Not recognized.
Recognized for a minute. Are you saying I do not have my minute?
The gentlelady.
Parliamentary inquiry, please.
Now, this is Donna Edwards from Maryland, stepping up to join in Representative Brown's defense.
Correct.
Shall suspend. Not recognized.
Recognized for a minute. Are you saying I do not have my minute?
The gentlelady.
Parliamentary inquiry, please. Mr. Speaker, a parliamentary inquiry.
The gentlelady will state her point of parliamentary inquiry.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Is it not in order, as we've heard many times on this floor, for a member of the House to simply not mention by name individual members of the House, but to mention categories of members? That happens all the time. Mr. Speaker, is it not in order when there are members on the other side of the aisle who have said Obama, Obamacare, that Nancy Pelosi is a train wreck on the floor of this House, and their words have not been taken down and they've not been seated? Is it not in order for the gentlelady to have been recognized and be able to speak on this issue merely saying Republicans? That could be a lowercase Republican.
The gentlelady will suspend. The gentlelady will suspend.
The other Negro will stop talking. We have too many talking Negroes here.
Ben, there's a currently demand for the words to be taken down pending before the body. The clerk will report the word. The gentlelady from Florida will be seated.
Don't you sit down, Representative Brown. Don't you sit. Oh, no. Don't you sit down.
I'm not going to apologize.
Did you catch that? It was kind of faint, but somebody came up to her and said, just apologize. And she said, I am not going to apologize. And you know what? She shouldn't. Nor should she have to. We are talking about an entire almost the entirety of a political party running the House of Representatives that desired beyond all reason, that desired beyond all charity, that desired beyond all of that Christian business that they so lugubriously babble, to condemn millions of American citizens to starvation. No, ma'am. No, ma'am. Don't you apologize. In fact, this is one of those stand up, Miss Jean Louise, your daddy's passing moments. I tell you what, if I am ever anywhere near Representative Corinne Brown, I'm going to stand up when that woman walks by. Because she has courage. these pasty-faced, Southern boys apparently think it is 1913 and not 2013.
Mr. Speaker, point of parliamentary inquiry. Mr. Speaker, is it in order to appeal your ruling?
The chair will advise the gentleman there's been no ruling. Request to take down the rules, take down the words before the House. The clerk will report the words. The chair will make a ruling. The gentleman's request would be in order at that time.
Then why did you tell the woman to sit down and shut up? That's what suspend means in House babble. It means shut up. Shut up! You know, like that.
Time.
You see how easily this poor, fragile, bedraggled, failing institution can be thrown into absolute chaos? One privileged white man says, I want the black woman to stop a-talking. And there actually has to be a period of time pass while people figure out whether or not the privileged white man should get his way and that the brown woman should shut up. Do you understand? And of course you do. I'm sorry. I feel bad every time. But when I point out that I sort of begin looking a little askance every time somebody, and especially a politician, talks about our democracy, that I kind of spit on the ground. This does not happen in a country that considers itself even having the first iota of democratic principles. Little d, not political party, little d democratic principles. Ah, democracy. It happens in autocracies. And the House of Representatives has devolved again. Anybody remember back during the days of the reign of Dim Leader and Denny the sweaty wrestler Hastert, Speaker of the House? Anybody remember when John Conyers was forced to hold a hearing in the broom closet of the House of Representatives, and when something was said that Republicans didn't like, they turned off his lights and microphone? Anybody remember that? Because I do. Our democracy, please.
The demand is withdrawn. The gentlelady from Florida may continue.
Oh, the demand is withdrawn. The gentlelady from Florida may continue. Ah, how nice. She has the permission of the white man to continue speaking. Isn't that charming?
Florida. Withdrawn. The gentlelady from Florida may resume her comments. The gentlelady from Florida has 42 seconds remaining.
Excuse me, Mrs. Speaker. Did you rule in my favor?
The demand has been withdrawn by the gentleman from Georgia. He has withdrawn his demand that the words be taken down. Therefore, the gentlelady from Florida may resume her comments. She has 42 seconds remaining.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. You know, this is a sad day in the House of Representatives. Would you
House
please turn the
order.
Mic on and please ask the House,
House to House will come to order. All members, please take their seats or take their conversations off the House floor. House will come to order. The gentlelady from Florida is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This is a sad day in the House of Representatives. I want you to know that. This is the people's house. And to separate the farm bill from the elderly, from the children, this is a shame.
Mitt Romney was right. You all do not care about the 47%. Shame on you.
And you know what? It was twice as effective that way. Shame on you. You're all just like Mitt Romney. You know what? That had to sting. Because Willard is pretty much acknowledged to be poison. Inside his own party now. And she just made them wear it. And in a body where victory is not possible, where it is foreclosed, sometimes you just have to do the right thing because it's the only thing that you're capable of doing and still managing to sleep at night. And that is what Corinne Brown did. We have no democracy. We don't have a functioning government. There's a blackmail attempt out there regarding the next debt ceiling crisis, when once again these barbarians will hold the country hostage to their bizarre Ayn Rand fantasies, in which they are trying to compel the President of the United States to do their bidding, to dance to the tune that they call. Well now, what happens? The House of Representatives has passed a farm bill. Granted, it does not speak to the issue of the ability of recent eaters of food to go on being eaters of food. And the Senate version speaks to the ability of a couple of million American citizens less being eaters of food. But now, if I recall correctly, doesn't this have to go to some sort of conference committee? And that is it's going to be hell among the yearlings. And heaven help the mariner. Because you're going to have a screaming barbarian rabble from the House of Representatives demanding that children cry in the night for hunger because we've got a deficit. And the Democratic side is to say, well, can't we have a few less children crying in the night from hunger? We're okay with having some children cry in the night from hunger, but can it just not be so many? And the Vandals and Visigoths from the right wing of from the Republican House, no, damn it, they've all got to cry. They need to learn to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. Hallelujah, glory. So that's that. Think we're done? Not by a long shot. Everybody keeps talking about, you know, the poor. And the problem is, some people actually want to see people, and when we're talking about the poor, remember, we're not talking about layabouts who don't do anything. We're talking about people who work is available to them. In the new normal, a world, thank you, Sandra, the new normal, a world of 7.6% or 7.4% unemployment. One of the Koch brothers, now which one was it? Charles. They're interchangeable. I think Charles and David Koch? Why don't we just call them both Dick? Charles Cote gave an interview to the Wichita Eagle. It was published this past Tuesday. And he, well, as a multi-billionaire whose daddy did business with Joseph Stalin and cashed the checks, you're damn right he did. Charles Cote, being a multi-billionaire, understands what it means to be poor. And he wants to help the poor. Here's how he wants to help the poor. We want to do a better job of raising up the disadvantaged and the poorest in this country, rather than saying, oh, we're just fine now. Listen, dipstick, I don't know anybody that's scrambling for a living out there that says, oh, we're just fine now. They say things like, how are we going to pay the power bill this month, dear? They say things like, honey, I'm getting real nervous driving on bald tires with the babies in the back seat. They say, I don't know how we're going to make it and have food all the way to the end of the month. The one thing that people struggling in this country are not saying is, oh, we're just fine now. We want to do a better job of raising up the disadvantaged. Disadvantaged. Can we consider that word? No, let's don't. Disadvantaged. In the world of Dick Coke, what the hell does that mean? That you didn't get the good seats at the polo chucker? We're not saying that at all. What we're saying is, we need to analyze all these additional policies, these subsidies, this cronyism, this avalanche of regulations, all these things that are creating a culture of dependency. Ah, there we go again, the culture of dependency. You know, it's in the nature of being a human being that you don't get to go on being a human being unless you depend on food and depend on water and depend on air and depend on shelter. As noted previously, we do not have the lightning quick reflexes of the cat or the night vision of the hyena or the distance vision of the hawk or eagle. We don't have the profound size of the elephant or the ability to withstand brutal cold of the bear. We have the ability as human beings to make shelter, to find food, to dig a well for water. And first and foremost, of all of those things, we have the ability to work together for the good of everyone in the group, to do those things. We have the ability to light a fire that will keep the hyenas and the leopards and the wolves and the coyotes out of our shelter at night. But if you're eating food for which Dick Coke has paid confiscatory taxes of so much as one goddamn penny, well, we're creating a culture of dependency. And like permitting to start a business in many cities to drive a taxi cab. Yeah, because you know all about cab driving, don't you, Dick Coke? To become a hairdresser. Anything that people with limited capital can do to raise themselves up, they keep throwing obstacles in their way. They who? You don't mean they you, do you, Dick? And so we've got to clear those out. Or the minimum wage. Or anything that reduces the mobility of labor. Oh, the mobility of labor. Well, bust my buttons. What he means by the mobility of labor is the ability of a working person to go from low-wage job to low-wage job to low-wage job with his hat or her hat in his or her hands, begging, please, mister, can I work for whatever godforsaken dimes you'll throw my way? Makes you kind of think that the boys in the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution of 1917 might have been on to something, doesn't it? Up against the wall, MF-er. Blindfold? No blindfold. Smoke? I don't smoke! Okay, no cigarette. Now this is the audio of an ad that is running in Kansas, of course. You know, where they've got a Christian governor by the name of Sam Brokeback or Groundback. And wait till you hear the argument.
Are you in the 1%? Well, if you earn over 30...
Oh, wait, what? Are you in the 1%? Because after all, that meme has gotten a lot of legs in the last couple of years, and we understand who the 1% are. The 1% are the Dick Cokes of the world. Right? Wrong! Wrong! No, that's not what the 1% means at all. Remember last night my conversation with Dr. John about the vast army of right-wing PR whores? Sorry, no insult intended. To whores. The vast army of syphilitic tramps in the PR industry who go hammer and tongs day and night trying to figure out a way to make up sound like down and day sound like night and wet feel like, sound like dry. Well, this is what you get from that crowd.
Are you in the 1%? Well, if you earn over $34,000 a year, you are one of the wealthiest 1% in the world.
Well, you're effing rich. Go get the Bugatti, sweetheart. So instead of talking about discrete units of cultures, say the 1% wealthiest in America, or the 1% wealthiest in France, or the 1% wealthiest in Germany, Japan, Australia, China. Yeah. No. That's not what that means at all. If you make more than $34,000 a year, well, you're in the 1%, baby! This should be interesting.
Are you in the 1%? Well, if you earn over $34,000 a year, you are one of the wealthiest 1% in the world. That is the power of economic freedom.
Huh? Economic freedom? So, you're making $34,000, you're making $35,000 a year, you got three kids, a mortgage, insurance payments, a car note, you got to pay a power bill, a water bill, the cable, the phone, buy groceries. Hopefully, well, you kind of gave up on that, didn't you? Send the kids to college. But you know what? You're a damn sight better off than a kid who with his family lives in a little cave in Pakistan or India that they've carved out of the old coal tailings. You got them licked, baby. You're living large. You're Elvis.
People in the most economically free countries earn, on average, over 8 times more than people in the least free. The poor earn 10 times as much. People in the most free countries...
You better be grateful, you poor bastards. You could be poor in Egypt. You ungrateful asshats. Why aren't you thanking Dick Koch? Why aren't you thanking Paul Ryan? Why aren't you thanking Louis Gohmert? You bunch of filthy, freaking poverty-infested ingrates.
A better protected civil rights, less unemployment, and the average person lives almost 20 years longer. Across the board, we see a strong...
Wait, lives long... where's the part about because of coal? This crap gets recycled from one issue to the next. I remember when Don Blankenship said that if we had windmills and solar panels in this country, we'd be living 32 to an apartment and riding bicycles to work if we had mass transit. Yeah, just like communist China.
Relationship between economic freedom and people's quality of life. The United States used to be a world leader in economic freedom, but our ranking fell. And it's projected to decline even further. The choice is ours. Let's rise again. The Charles Koch Foundation.
The Dick Koch Foundation. Gee, I wonder why our economic freedom really fell. You know, a bunch of those countries that are ahead of us have things like universal single-payer or something approaching universal single-payer government-mandated health insurance. You know they have meaningful pensions. You know they have actual vacations for working people every year. So, oddly enough, it doesn't turn out it's the damn minimum wage that's, you know, that's keeping the Mons neck on our jackbooted neck on our throats. It turns out it's Dick Koch. Up against the wall, MF-er. And yet, when Dick and Dick sit down to talk to each other, and they talk about how they want taxes cut, they, oh, but Dick, brother dear, I don't want to cut taxes because it will mean that we become even more wealthy by the second than we already are. Oh no, perish the thought, brother Dick. Oh no, brother Dick, I agree wholeheartedly. We're doing it for those poor bastards. Meanwhile, of course, let's remember that Dick Koch and Dick Koch get more welfare than an entire West Virginia holler combined. And they get it in oil subsidies. And they get government contracts. And you know what? When it turns out that their economic theories have gone to caca, well, hell, they get bailed out, baby. When's the last time you heard of somebody who's gone past their 99th week of unemployment getting bailed out? Yeah. I despise them. I loathe them. When the news finally comes that Dick Koch or Dick Koch has gone on to their just reward, I want to go to the funeral. And I want to sit and giggle and cackle like a fool in the back of whatever godforsaken church is willing to bury those hell-bound freaks. Wouldn't it be nice if there was a hell? Wouldn't life feel ever so much better if you knew that there was a hell waiting for Dick and Dick Koch? And Jack in Shreveport just pointed out something. And I think it sort of dovetails into something that Dr. John said the other evening. Remember when Dr. John mentioned that freedom is not necessarily defined as the freedom to purchase among 27 different brands of breakfast cereal? Well, Jack just noticed something in the clip that I played a moment ago. subject line, freedom ad. Jack writes, I noticed they use the terms freedom and economic freedom interchangeably. To them, freedom means being free to steal as much as possible from everybody else, no matter how much damage is done. You know, because they're rugged individuals. Oh, but wait, from Dr. John. Culture of dependency. Human beings depend on other people, too. Dr. John noting, lone, rugged, individual humans die quickly. Like all primates, we need to be social to survive. It's only been that way at least 5 million years. But in the last 250, and I would argue really in the last 75, we've come up with this notion. I mean, hell, even kings, sometimes they had to be dragged to it kicking and screaming. Say, you know, King John of England on the field at Runnymede, perhaps. But even kings recognized that there wasn't a whole lot of fun in the kinging business if you didn't have some barons and some lords and some earls and some suffixes and prefixes running around doing your kingly business and making all the wealth flow upward. In the last 75 years, this goofy-ass notion, and I don't know, Dr. John, where does it come from? Is it because of the whole manifest destiny thing and the rolling across the vastness of this continent and settling parts of it, and people living in sod huts on the Nebraska plain? Anybody ever read Willa Cather's My Antonia? It's worth the time. I mean, it ain't no little house on the prairie. Anybody ever read Pearl S. Buck's The Good Earth? Now, granted, that's China, but there's still a lot to be learned. What is it? Where does this idea of rugged individual come from? Did it come from the moving picture studios? With Tom Mix riding along on his horse? Because you know what? It wasn't rugged individualism when, for whatever their motives, when the Tennessee Volunteers struck out heading for Texas in the Alamo, that was not a manifestation of rugged individualism. There are damned few actual historical examples of rugged individualism. I mean, even my forebear that I've talked about in the past, Long Billy, he wasn't so good at the rugged individualism business. He tried the rugged individualism gig and wound up going back to Fort Hoosas. And then came back and tried again and wound up having to hide his wife and children in the swamp every day just to keep retribution from being taken upon them by the people whose land they'd stolen, you know, being as how they were rugged individuals and all. Rugged individuals. But sitting there, sipping their 500-year-old cognac or what the hell ever, the Koch brothers have got themselves convinced that they did it all on their own when they never did a damn thing. They were born on third thinking they hit an effing triple. Sparky in the chat room suggesting Mountain Man Bob Kincaid. You know, Jeremiah Johnson had to come off the mountain and go down to the trading post. You're right, Jug of Punch. Dick and Dick Coke, that was exactly the same thing I thought. Trading places. And a bet for a dollar. And manipulating markets. But we are dealing with... Yeah, Marty said the same thing. Sounds like the scene with Don Ameche and Ralph Bellamy from Trading Places. With Dan Aykroyd playing Lewis Winthorpe, Don Ameche's Mortimer Duke. We seem to be paying one of our employees an awful lot of money. Can't get around the old... We seem to be paying some of our employees an awful lot of money. Can't get around the old minimum wage, Mortimer. Jesus Christ. Economic freedom. You know, economic freedom is a lot more related to the ability. Well, how much economic freedom is there if you can't get away from the economy? How much economic freedom is there if you have to play the game? How much fun is a fun house that they drive you into and which you cannot exit? Jeebus. Not much. Not much. Freedom. Word. They're making everything that even remotely resembles a noble impulse in this country into a filthy thing. And freedom, that idea, is at the very heart of it. So we are at about 8 minutes before the hour. This is Conversation Radio, you know. I'm sorry for the technical flamoxery that cheated us out of a few minutes of the program. Several minutes. But it is Conversation Radio, and if you want to get involved, that's cool. We've got a bunch of stories to hit as well. But it's up to you. You know the number, 304-658-3333. Bob Kincaid Horn on Skype. And just to let you know how things are going, I want to extend our ongoing thanks to Sal, who got us started this evening. All we got to do now is raise, as he often does almost every evening, all we got to do now is raise $140. 14 people, 10 bucks a piece between, say, now and it'd be nice if it happened between now and the end of the show. Can we do that? Let's try. Green News Report upcoming. This is Conversation Radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
next Thursday, July 11, 2013.
Well, these six women have been climbing since 4 o'clock this morning.
Six Greenpeace activists scale Shell Tower to protest Arctic drilling.
When we make the decision, it has ripple effects that reach far beyond both of our borders.
U.S. and China agree to cut emissions. Air pollution even more deadly than thought. Plus,
this is a report from the Department of Energy, and it talks about the weather and the change that it's having and how it's already causing disruption to our country's energy supply.
Fox News reports on climate change.
What, huh? All of those mysteries and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comments.
There's a lot of things happening that the enviro-socialists are... it is a cult. It is a bona fide cult.
You heard it here first, straight from the heart of the bona fide Wall Street cult known as CNBC. This is your Green News Report, cultists. Okay, Desi Doyen, a lot of actually kind of fun stories today for a change, it seems.
Yeah, for once.
Except for that John Kerry part, but we'll get to that in a minute.
Yes, but first, let's talk about that CNBC comment you heard from Joe Kernan in our snarky comment. CNBC failed its viewers when it ridiculed economists who accurately warned about the 2008 stock market crash and Great Recession. Now, CNBC is failing its viewers again in ridiculing the warnings of climate scientists. And a new Media Matters study has found that the majority of CNBC's coverage of climate change casts doubt on whether it even exists.
So they ignore the economists warning about the economy, and they're now ignoring the climatologists worrying about the climate.
Right, and it's a recipe for disaster, as we've already seen.
Indeed.
Oh, and come on, CNBC. Even Fox News reported on the new Department of Energy report showing the nation's energy infrastructure is extremely vulnerable to climate change and extreme weather.
The Department of Energy says that it's likely to get worse as the weather gets more extreme, like some of the storms we've been seeing, higher temperatures, more frequent droughts, and apparently the effects are already being felt. Remember all the massive power disruptions that were caused by Superstorm Sandy?
What I love about that Fox News report is that they give a warning about what they're about to report, like this.
It has to do with climate change, and I guess we should mention off the top that there are those who are skeptical of climate change.
Yes, I wonder if when they do a report about the Holocaust on Fox News, they give a warning that there are some who are skeptical about the Holocaust having happened.
God, I hope not. Meanwhile, elsewhere, the Pine Island Glacier in Antarctica has calved an iceberg as big as Chicago. Warming ocean waters are melting and weakening Antarctic sea ice from underneath. As a result, the leading edge of the Pine Island Glacier in Antarctica on Wednesday broke off into a massive iceberg that is not just bigger than the island of Manhattan, it could easily fit 8 Manhattan Islands on it.
Could it reach far enough inland to reach both the NBC headquarters at Rockefeller Center and the Fox News building? They're like right across the street from each other.
We already know carbon pollution from burning fossil fuels is causing the atmosphere and oceans to warm. We now have even more proof that burning fossil fuels also causes deadly air pollution, even more dangerous than previously thought. 2 new studies on particulate exhaust, that's minuscule soot from tailpipes that lodge directly in the lungs, confirms earlier studies that show even low-level long-term exposure to fossil fuel air pollution leads directly to higher rates of lung cancer and heart failure.
Okay, that was also one of the not fun stories.
Sorry. Meanwhile, new research from China shows just how deadly coal pollution is. The Chinese government has been giving away free coal to people in the north.
For Christmas?
No, just to keep them warm. Oh. But it has had the unintended side effect of causing deadly air pollution that has reduced life expectancy by more than 5 years.
Lousy Christmas gift.
Yeah, researchers say that could explain why life expectancy in China has not increased along with economic growth. But China will be cutting coal pollution. Secretary of State John Kerry on Wednesday announced a major new international agreement between China and the U.S., the world's biggest emitters, to cut emissions.
We together have a responsibility to meet the emerging challenges that affect us and draw attention to those challenges to the rest of the world.
This is a big deal. It cuts pollution from industry, vehicles, and coal-fired power plants to cut those emissions that are contributing to global warming. Finally, in London, on Thursday...
Well, these six women have been climbing since 4 o'clock this morning. As long as governments think that oil companies can reach oil in ever more ridiculous places, they've no imperative to start engaging with developing efficiency technologies.
Six Greenpeace protesters climbed to the top of Shell Oil's London headquarters, the tallest skyscraper in Europe called the Shard, because it resembles a shard of ice. Ironic, because the climbers are protesting Shell's ongoing disastrous efforts to drill for oil in the Arctic.
And can we point out here that these six protesters who climbed this huge building are also women?
Yeah.
Because normally, you know, it's guys who do this. So I want to give credit where it's due. Way to go, ladies. For much more on that story, including some video of this remarkable climb and the other stories we couldn't get to, please check out our website today at greennews.bradblog.com. While you're there, please consider sponsoring the Green News Report with a donation to the Brad Blog. We don't have Shell Oil money, or Greenpeace money for that matter, so we rely on you. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
Yeah, sorry about the 800 number. I've so got to get the imaging recut for all of this. Note to self, get 48-hour day. 4 minutes past the hour as we move into, the final hour of tonight's Thorn in the Side Thursday. Thanks to Juanita. Juanita hit the PayPal button and took a bite out of tonight's fundraising total. We now need to raise, thanks to Sal and thanks to Juanita, we now need to raise only $125 to get us right for tonight so we don't have a deficit. Oh, that word. Tomorrow evening for Friday on the front porch. So that means that we are 275 away from finishing the week to the good. And thanks also to Waggy. He was one of those alongside. Well, he was the one alongside our buddy Horst, who cleared up the backlog so that we only had to raise our usual night's 150 this evening. Thank you very much, Waggy. And apparently, and just so you'll know, the newish widget over at headonradionetwork.com, where you just, if you want to take the trouble of remembering out of the equation, the new widget that allows you to just set up a recurring monthly contribution does work. And Waggy proved it. Thank you, Waggy, and thank you all. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's John. How you doing?
Hey, Dr. John, how you doing?
Doing all right. Listen, I'd like to also just add my thanks to the folks who are able to contribute to keep this going. I am looking forward to the day when I can jump back in. But many, many thanks to those folks who are just dedicated day in, day out.
Indeed, and thanks to you, because you've done a bunch in your own right.
Oh, I appreciate that. Listen, you made a terrific point there in the last hour. How much freedom is there if you have to participate in the economy? I think that's splendid, and that really got at what I was trying to say the other day too. Is that, you know, we really need to be more clear about what we mean by freedom. You know, it's absence of coercion. It's not simply endless choices.
Right, and coercion doesn't mean paying taxes.
Right, right, exactly. That's participating in the group. You know, you don't want to pay taxes, that's fine, but we can't have a society like we do now.
Well, the society that we have right now is not going to last very long on its present course, do you think, John?
Yeah, I think I'm on record as agreeing with that.
You know, we try in our own way to push back against these right-wing tropes, what have you. But I mean, how does it happen on a larger scale? I mean, is this education? Is it being out in the streets with some sort of sign that says freedom isn't what you think it is?
No, I think it's the old saying from the protest. You know, it's living the change that you want to see. And our side's actually really good at that. I mean, the horn is a good example. Like I said, people stepping into the breach when, you know, not everyone can contribute in the same way. But, you know, some people call, some people email, and some people are able to financially support. And there's some churn between those groups. And that's what community is about, working towards a greater goal by your action. And we see that in all kinds of lefty protests. Go back again to North Carolina and Texas with the anti-woman legislation and the protests against that. It's cross-class, it's cross-race, it's cross-gender. You know, we're actually pretty good at that. But that sort of living and community building, I think, is the only antidote to this idea that we're separate, in competition individual.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. And the challenge then becomes, and I think we saw it a little bit with the Occupy movement, how do you sustain that energy level? How do you make it? This is a phrase that they used in workers' compensation back in the day. How do you make it a transferable skill?
Yeah, and transferable between issues too. You know, one thing we are often bad about is seeing issues as separate. You know, not connected. That's an issue. But to me, the root of the issue, the root problem really is this concept of how we treat, you know, what it means to be human and what the right way to act is. Have you heard, come across the phrase homo economicus before?
Yes.
Yeah. Economic man. And the idea there is, this goes back to, Adam Smith and John Stuart Mill and David Ricardo. The idea that what humans, are meant to do is to act at all times in their own rational economic self-interest.
Yeah, or the term is sometimes bandied about enlightened self-interest.
Enlightened self-interest, but it's a construct. And what enlightened means is that you are making a very conscious decision to maximize your own profit in all of your social interactions. So what's interesting is that Mill himself said this is a model. This is a construct. You know, this is the way that economists have to think about people in order to do their economic stuff, to understand behavior. He never really said that it was the way people really act, but in the 120 years since then, we've taken that to be a model for how to live. In other words, we always have to act in competition with other people. We have to sever any ties with kin and friends and family in order to pursue our own beneficial profit maximization. And that's a really, really dim way to look at.
Well, it is, and I wonder, just as I wondered where the concept of rugged individualism comes from, John, where does that, I mean, it's not, and yes, Mill and Smith, but where, I mean, was it like Venus bursting forth from the head of Zeus full formed, or does it have an evolutionary path as well?
Well, those guys are the and I'll say this word in sort of its church sense. They were the first apologists for capitalism, right? They were observing social phenomena that were happening and trying to justify them, to explain why what's happening is right. These are guys who are writing in the 18th and 19th century, looking at changes that started in rural England, with land enclosure and workers being forced into factories and the development of a wage system and that sort of thing. And they're saying, well, this is happening, so we need to explain why it works and why it's the right way to do it. Because obviously we're Englishmen and this is happening in England, so this must be, you know, the end of history. This must be what humankind has been designed to do.
Yeah, this is what the whole thing's been leading up to.
Right, exactly, and we all kind of suffer that fallacy of our living in our own times. But they were,
but John, they were classically trained, right?
Sure.
I mean, they certainly had more of a familiarity with the classics than I do.
Yes.
How do you? I mean, you talk about the enclosure of the land, for instance. How do you look at something like that and not look back at the devolution of Republican Rome,
which they all idolized. And that's why I'm asking about sort of the evolutionary path to this. Rome got the late Roman Republic got in the trouble it did because they had driven all of the subsistence farmers off the subsistence farmers' land. And in turn, the wealthy elite that really were a 1% took control of that land and began to farm it with slaves, of which there had been a vast influx, and who were a very, very profitable item. They began to farm the land with slaves, thereby drove people into the rickety tenements of Rome, and into what eventually became proto-revolution. So I wonder how you miss something like that if you're John Stuart Mill or Adam Smith, or is it a case of not seeing something that, and you know, bad scientists do this all the time, I guess. You don't see, if you see something you don't like, you just stop seeing it.
I mean, don't forget too that this was the England. This was the greatest empire the world had ever seen. I suspect that they would look at what happened in Rome and say, well, the reason it didn't work there, even though some of the same things were happening, is because they weren't the British Empire. You know, they weren't as smart as we are. You know, they weren't as white as we are. They didn't have this mission to civilize the world, spread our culture, our language, our economy, draw from the colonies. You know, I think it's ethnocentrism, racism, you know, presentism.
Yeah, and the other thing I wonder about is, of course, Jean Calvin. We know him as John Calvin,
mm-hmm.
who created a brutalizing form of Protestantism that essentially said, if you're wealthy, it's because God likes you. And therefore, the ceaseless churning for wealth is actually the ceaseless churning for God's favor.
Mm-hmm.
And thereby, you know, marrying the pursuit of wealth with the pursuit of the kingdom of God. These things, and you know, Calvinism gets married up a little bit inside the Church of England. There were repressions and purges and all the horrors that religion brings with it, but it really, you know, we really do begin to see this with the things that you're describing. We begin to see this as not the culmination, the pinnacle of human endeavor, but rather an artificial construct that has failed. Is that fair?
Well, it's failed unless you're the people in power. You know, it's very hard for people who are profiting from this to see that there is failure. Policymakers and rich folks. So from where they're sitting, it's working just fine. I mean, globalization for them is a great thing because, hey, what's the problem with making money by shipping jobs to China or India? And then when they start getting too uppity, then we'll go to the Philippines and Malawi. Yeah, you know, it's a big world. I mean, it's finite, but that's long-term thinking. We can't do that.
Right, and why would you do any long-term thinking if your short-term thinking is making you fabulously wealthy?
Keeping the shareholders happy, right.
Yeah. It fascinates me and has become more and more fascinating to me. It's like I said the other night about, you know, needing a little time on the shores of Lake Como with, you know, a good umbrella and a book. But absent Lake Como, I think I can still get the book and, if I have to, the umbrella. And I'm digging around a little bit more because it's a helpless feeling, John, to feel like you're trapped in something and there's no way to opt out. And we've seen those opt out movements in the past, the utopian movements that swept upstate New York, for instance.
Yeah.
In the 19th century. And in fact, I think you can argue even that my Scots-Irish forebears, in doing what they did, even though it was wrong, were themselves trying to opt out in a way, to get as far away from the power of the crown as they possibly could. Because, you know, the American Revolution itself gets sort of birthed
out of the refusal of the colonists to stay put, because the Crown of England had made certain certain agreements with Cherokee people, with Haudenosaunee people, Shawnee people, particularly the Shawnee, they weren't going to come across the Allegheny front, and that they would be left in peace where they were. And it's, you know, and then you get Braddock's War and the Tuendi Way fight and Logan's reprisal and then Logan's refusal, and all because there were a group of people who wanted to get as far away from a system that was not meeting their needs. You know, a lot of the people who came across the mountains at one point in time or another had been those indentured servants who had literally sold their bodies into slavery in order to book passage to the New World. But the whole goal there was that once the indenture was done, that they were going to get the hell away. And maybe we've dovetailed into where the rugged individualism comes from too.
Well, maybe so, but it was also in some ways a, laughingly say, a rational economic decision, because a lot of those folks who ran away figured, well, you know, I've got these debts, I can't pay them off, or I've got this indenture and I can't get out of it. So I'm going to move where the state can't reach me. So I'm going to go into the space between the powers and states, and then get beyond the reach of them. And there is a parallel to what's happening with Occupy and with other. These are things that are happening where people are coming together and communities are organizing outside the bounds of the state. You know, Sandy, the hurricane that hit up here in the Northeast. You know. Absolute failure, abject failure by New York State and other states and the federal government to get relief to people. And so what happened is people who branded under Occupy said, okay, well, we're going to occupy Sandy, and we're going to organize neighborhoods to rebuild and to get food to people who need it and to get fuel to folks who don't have power for weeks and even months afterwards. And this is kind of what I'm saying, is that this community organization is a really powerful and kind of a revolutionary act, because you're saying we don't need to follow the dictates and guidelines of what the people in power are telling us. We're going to organize ourselves. And that's a powerful statement, I think, to say, power of community over competition.
How does it, and you referenced in a conversation the other night, John, the fact that that Occupy had some problems as far as sustaining and going forward, how do you make the next leap into creating that alternate system so that people can opt away from a system that brutalizes human beings in the name of profit?
Well, we see it in workers' co-ops, for instance, I'm forgetting the name, Richard Wolf talks about this sort of alternate economic system of organizing labor. You see it in community gardens. I mean, things like that. I'm really more and more convinced that it's not big revolutionary acts to free people from oppression. It's not marching on Washington. I think it's on a neighborhood level and on a community level. You know, folks who say, you know, we're going to live near our family. We're not going to move away for a job. We're going to open our Wi-Fi networks. We're going to start community gardens, and we're going to help feed people and house people and get people information that they need and help out our neighbors rather than, you know, competing against them at all times. And I don't think that it's organized in any way that I can tell, but it seems like there's a lot of sprouting up of these little.
And I think there are places that are more conducive to such sproutings, if you will.
Certainly.
It's certainly much more commonly to be seen in places like Oregon, Washington, places like California, Vermont, upstate New York. But that does not mean that it is precluded elsewhere. You know, I remember Brother Albert talking about the fact that, you know, they'll take a little bit of, and there's the term, an economic hit.
Mm-hmm.
To make sure that they go and shop at get their groceries at the local co-op, and that in itself is I don't want to you know over dramatize it, but that in itself, is it not, John, an act of rebellion?
Well, it is, and I don't want to over-dramatize and suggest that, you know, opening your Wi-Fi network is going to change everything. I mean, it's not, but it's all these little accumulated small changes in the way we live and the way we think about ourselves and our relationships with other human beings that, in the aggregate, is kind of a rejection of this homo economicus model. You know, homo reciprocans, the opposite. The idea that you work, the things that you do are designed to create relationships with other people and that you benefit from that. Because you do, we know that. I mean, there are tiny human societies all over the world, all through history, have subsisted, not because people are in competition with each other, but because the things you do for your neighbors and people in your kin group, you do because you know that then they're going to owe you and they're going to help you out when you're in trouble.
Right, and so if you're in a place like I am, West Virginia, maybe it's as simple as when spring rolls around saying, let's work the garden together instead of you work yours and I'll work mine. Is that how it germinates?
It certainly couldn't hurt.
Well, it certainly provides a lot of food for thought, because you said something a minute ago about the change is not to be had by marching on Washington, and I know I'm guilty of saying that, you know, we need to have a million people in Washington D.C., but I always add a caveat to that of, but it doesn't count if you show up on Saturday and you're gone on Sunday. That's not protest. That's street theater.
Yeah.
And there is, to be fair, there's rather of an industry out there, and see, here we are using capitalist economic terms, but there's an industry out there that exists to do exactly those things. And I don't know, John, if it's just a failure of imagination, or if it is. And I believe you me, I've had this conversation on a topic that is near and dear to my heart a lot. I don't know if it's a failure of imagination or if it is a matter of it proves to be economically viable for those who do such things. And I haven't come to a satisfactory conclusion on that. Because, you know, there are a lot of good. I mean, the story that was on the Green News Report about the Greenpeace climbers on the Shard in London. You know, I have profound respect for the courage it took to do that.
Sure.
And in fact, I consider him a friend. I know the guy who basically, from the ground up, created the nonviolent direct action civil disobedience model that Greenpeace uses to this day, to the point that he was the one who helped put in place. I mean, did you know that Greenpeace runs a climbing school? That Greenpeace runs a watercraft school? I mean, you can go out there and they will teach you to do these things and to do them safely and to do them effectively.
Wow.
And so Ferg came within that much of going to watercraft school this past spring. They run it out in Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
But these people who did the climbing in London had been trained by Greenpeace. And there are a lot of people of tremendous goodwill who do that work, but they do that work within that model.
Yeah.
And the question is, not what good is it, but how does it engage a larger populace, a larger community? Let's use that word. How does it engage a larger community in taking further action?
It gets the attention of Shell. It gets the attention of policymakers. It gets the attention of folks who are plugged in, and that's important. And in the same way, advocacy on Capitol Hill is vitally important because that's directed right at the people who make these decisions. It's absolutely important. But as far as the people who live around me, for instance, they don't know or care about it. You know, if I tried to talk to them about it, they wouldn't care. But if I, you know, help the old lady across the street till her garden next summer and, you know, then we establish this relationship and we start sharing food, that's a direct action that touches a life, community in it, and then who knows where that would go, you know. Someone tried to break into my house, and maybe she's watching and calls the cops, you know, instead of just letting it happen. That's the kind of thing, is that these little revolutionary acts, the ones you have to think about who they touch. Big actions, advocacy of lawmakers, that touches one group of people. Small individual acts of kindness and reciprocity touches a very different kind of people. They're both important.
Right, and they can both be absolutely complementary.
Absolutely, yeah.
And you having opened the door for me, John, let me go ahead and take us here. Speaking of advocacy in D.C., I wanted to make sure that I let people know this evening. My colleague Bo Webb has been in Washington. I was supposed to be there this week, but you know I've got the crud, and I didn't want to give it to him. But he's in Washington D.C. And we have taken a new tack with the ACAT. We had a sort of a sit down and a skull sweat session, and we realized that we've got to have this bill introduced in the Senate.
Right.
And we also realized that when January comes, you know, January is going to be 2014, which means election year, which also means that precious little else is going to get accomplished.
Right.
So we reached the conclusion that the AIC Act has got to be introduced in the Senate of the United States this year, before December the 31st.
Mm-hmm.
And with this being the month in which the July, oddly enough, for reasons known but to God, is the month that the Republicans in the Congress has decided to work more than any other month, more actual days working than any other month. So our tactic is to spend July, I mean, we're still working in the House, but spend July really, really zeroing our focus in on the Senate. And so, you know, when I go back to D.C., I'll still be taking some House meetings, but my focus, again, is going to be meetings inside the Senate and hopefully getting a bill introduced. And with that in mind, I wanted to let folks know that Bo told me today that he had a very, very productive meeting with a staffer from Senator Kirsten Gillibrand's office.
Oh.
And
okay, from New York, right.
Yes.
She's the junior senator from New York. Okay.
Right. And has some pretty respectable progressive credentials.
She does.
And they were very open and very receptive to what Bo was talking about, and very much knowledgeable not only of what mountaintop removal is, but of the health risks that it poses to people who have to live with it. So those
wow.
are, you know, those are two pluses.
Yeah.
But the Senate being the collegial so-called bunch that they are, you know, there's fewer of them than there are in the House. And since there's only two per state, there's actually, well, talking about democracy, the Senate, of all the various governmental bodies of the federal government, the Senate is probably the least democratic. Because, in fact, you've got a minority in the Senate that is able to stop the Senate's business, and yet that minority represents less than one-third of the citizens of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So one senator from Alabama, with its millions of people, can stop something desired by a senator from California with its tens of millions of people.
Right.
But with that in mind, we are going to focus on the Senate, and Senator Gillibrand was her office was quite receptive. But what you always run across is that on issues that are deemed to be regional, senators don't like to step on other senators' toes.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the thinking goes that, oh, say, Senator Boxer of California would not take it very kindly if Senator Rockefeller of West Virginia was to come in and start introducing laws about what would happen in California. So necessarily for the AIC Act to be reintroduced, it has to be bipartisan. Lucky for us, we've had some very, very meaningful conversations with a couple of actual Republican senators.
And we think we're building the base for that bipartisanship. So all of this comes around to me saying that they were very receptive in Senator Gillibrand's office, but they don't necessarily know that they want to introduce or sponsor the introduction of the AIC Act there.
Mm-hmm.
So I would suggest that, and we've got a lot of listeners in New York State, John.
Mm-hmm.
I would suggest that maybe a good thing would be, if people would be so kind as to do it, to write, email, call, whatever, Senator Gillibrand's office, and suggest to whoever answers the phone that as a constituent of Senator Gillibrand, you not only support human rights in Appalachia, but that you, moreover, would appreciate seeing her take the lead on something that is so utterly and absolutely important for American citizens who happen to live in Appalachia. And of course, Appalachia is not just West Virginia. It's an entire region of the country that's being poisoned.
No, I live in Appalachia, actually, so, and it runs right through New York.
Well, yes, you do, absolutely.
Well, that is splendid. Now, can you suggest, would you suggest saying, well, the phrasing is she's hesitant to.
Well, I wouldn't even suggest that, you know, that she's hesitant. A simple statement,
right,
of I am a constituent of Senator Gillibrand, and I very much am supportive of her sponsoring or co-sponsoring the Senate equivalent of H.R. 526, the AIC Act.
Sponsoring or co-sponsoring the Senate equivalent of H.R. 526.
Right.
The AIC Act. That's outstanding. Well, I will be on the phone tomorrow. And in fact, I think she has an office here in my city. Might be. You think a guy going by there is
If there's a local office, it would be beneficial, mm-hmm, because it's always nice to put a name with a phone number. And maybe then at the same time you pick up the phone and you call the D.C. office.
Oh, definitely. That's outstanding. That's great news. I'm glad to hear that. And believe me, I will be doing that tomorrow.
Well, I appreciate it. And I hope a whole lot more of the members of the Horn Family Commune will do the same. And just because we're talking about New York doesn't mean that you're precluded somewhere else. For instance, you know, Senators Corker and Alexander in Tennessee are on record as being quite nonplussed, unhappy with mountaintop removal. They don't like it because, see, Tennessee, though a southern state and though ostensibly a red state, has a very, very much enlightened core to it.
Mm-hmm.
So that they understand very, very much that mountaintop removal poses a grave threat to the tourism industry that means, oh my God, vast amounts of money to Tennessee. And so, you know, if you live in Tennessee, pick up the phone, call Senator Corker, pick up the phone, call Senator Alexander, or if they've got a local office in your town, drop by and say, listen, I just wanted to let the senator know that I would not only be approving of, but deeply thankful if they would step up and protect our Tennessee mountains from mountaintop removal and make sure that it ends by co-sponsoring or sponsoring the Senate equivalent of H.R. 526, the AIC Act. And, you know, if it's Barbara Boxer in California, the same speech can be made to her. The same speech can be made all over this country. And I think it would be highly, highly beneficial to do so because, among other things, and this is just a little bit of how the Senate works, Dr. John, like we said, it's a much smaller body than the House of Representatives. So there are 100 senators, and every senator has a legislative assistant, an aide, whose job is so-called environmental issues, and another one whose job is health issues. Well, if your job is environment, you talk frequently to other environmental LAs.
Right.
And we know for a fact that it's already getting around in these Senate offices that we're on the ground in D.C. and that we are looking to get this bill introduced. So, you know, if they get a phone call that winds up with a, you know, with one of those little pink while you were out slips filled in, or via the computer probably now, saying, you know, Joe Smith called in from Pigeon Forge saying he don't want no mountaintop removal and he wants it ended and he doesn't want people poisoned by it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it begin and if Senator Boxer's LA is standing in the room and saying, well, son of a gun, I've started getting calls too. And then they look at each other and go, wait a minute, California, Tennessee? And Tammy Baldwin's LA from Wisconsin says, I got the same thing.
Yeah.
Oh, wait a minute. They're serious about this. And there are people out there that are our constituents who go and do things like voting and even maybe make political contributions, and they want this done. And it begins to have some serious weight to it. I think based on the meetings that Bo's had and based on the meetings that I had, I think we can get it done, John. But we cannot get it done without a whole lot of community action, which is, of course, in the nature of what you were talking about. Even this sort of thing is a little bit of a revolutionary idea.
Absolutely. Well, that is splendid news. I will be on this tomorrow, and I will report to you how it goes. That's great. Thanks for the work. And listen, I'm gonna drop out here and let some other folks get a chance. But I appreciate it. This is good to hear, and I'll be in touch with you soon.
Well, thank you so very much, John. I really appreciate all of the knowledge that you bring to this, because it shines a much brighter light on things that aren't necessarily easy to comprehend. The stuff that's right in your face sometimes is the hardest to see, because it's tough to bring that focus in that tight. So have a good evening, John.
You too. Take care.
Bye. Right. Bye now. Dr. John calling from upstate New York. There have been, Ohio Horn family members. How about a call to Sherrod Brown's office? Yeah, that could work. Vermont, Bernie Sanders, please. Patrick Leahy, please. I believe that Ed Markey will be sworn in as a member of the Senate of the United States in a matter of days, Ed Markey of Massachusetts. How about a call to his office the minute he becomes a senator? Because, you know, he was the leader of the minority side of the Environment Committee in the House of Representatives that produced the brilliant report a year ago that pointed out that even if demand for mountaintop removal coal diminishes on the domestic side, that there actually mountaintop removal is increasing because exports are increasing. So he is intimately familiar with mountaintop removal. And how about helping to bring him on board? We've already had meetings in Elizabeth Warren's office. How about her? I think, and I only think this because of how and who you are, I think we can do this. How about Maria Cantwell in Washington? How about Wyden in Oregon? See, Ron Wyden sits as the chair of the committee that the AIC Act, if it was introduced in the Senate, might very well be referred to. That's very important. How about Jeff Merkley, who was elected to the Senate from Oregon on an almost exclusively environmental platform? I think we can do this if we are determined and if we work together. If you would be so kind as to let me know by email, bobkincaid@gmail.com or on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, let me know that you've reached out, and we'll make sure that those letters go out so that we're in those offices. That's what I've said all along, and that's what we've been doing all along. So I think it's a viable plan of action. Let's go back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
It's only me again.
Only you?
Yes.
Only?
Wise ass, you know?
Quit sandbagging.
Well, when you start talking about the situation in West Virginia, you know, people don't realize they're just continuing what they've done down there for years. The difference is now it doesn't even employ people in the numbers that it once did.
Oh, no. There are less than... we've gone from 100,000 to 15,000.
Jesus, and that was a prime way of making a living in certain parts of your state.
In just about all parts of our state.
Really?
Yeah, unless it was maybe the far eastern border counties with Virginia and up into the eastern panhandle. Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah, well, the eastern panhandle, that... I'll never forget. I don't know if I told you the story that I was coming from a down south vacation one year, and we came up. All I can remember is a sign pointing me toward the Paw Paw Bends. Have you ever seen those?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I wanted to see that bridge they blew up to through the mountains to run the C&O Canal through it. It's still in condition.
Yeah, and of course the Big Bend Tunnel. Famous via the legend of John Henry.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Is very much a real thing. And for years, they had a statue of John Henry there, but the Klan kept vandalizing it.
Oh, okay.
Not kidding.
The canals were of interest. That's one thing about it. I hate to sound like an old guy, but, man, there were books out when I was a kid, the Landmark series.
Mm-hmm.
And you learn so much about, like, the canals. The C&O always caught my attention. If you go on your way to Antietam, you can't miss it, you know?
Right.
You go right over it. But I thought I'd give you a quick laugh. On the same ride home, I went by a place that had this huge fence around it. And it was a fence with the intertwining in it. Where you see you couldn't see through the fence.
Right, yeah.
Extremely high. It was Bambi Lee's massage parlor. When I saw how high those fences were, I said, oh, high fence, high vehicles, semi-trucks. Oh. And it gave me a good laugh on the way home. But I also wanted to say something that, who's the young man who's an ex-Marine who calls in? I keep forgetting.
Oh, that's Mark.
Yeah, I appreciate the things he talks about. He really hits it on the head, because that's one thing we need more of is people who have, stood up there and served that flag and are serving it by serving it in a different way now, and they sure earned the right to do it. I won't stay on for very long, but I wanted to thank this. A couple guys from Ohio that have been really good to me. You know one of them, you know the other one, too. He's a little south of me between here and Akron, and he's a really good guy. And it's just been wonderful to listen to these callers. That last young man just reminds me so much of what I saw of people who were thinking that way in the 60s, and I hope that this time around they can get it to work. Because it's necessary. I don't know if people know how much, and you might know it, how big the barter system was going on in this country.
Oh, well, I mean, at one point, in frontier times, money was scarce. I mean, most people don't realize, Bill, that for a number of decades of the United States government's earliest years, yeah, we had a dollar. But the most common denomination of currency that one could count on being accepted everywhere was the Spanish piece of eight.
Yeah, they were much more valuable than the greenback. I mean, there was money troubles during the Civil War, were there not? I'm not exactly well tuned to it. I was never an economics person, Bob. I mean, economics was. How much can I save of what I'm making? How much work can I do on my own material, my own repairs, my own, if I could figure out how to pull my own teeth, I would have done it, But not that good. But it got so big in the 70s that there was actual griping coming out of D.C. about it. you know, people were trading labor or exchanging. And what was the name of the market, the cash market, where people were not, you know, they were paying for services in cash, and nothing was being exchanged, and so they weren't taxing it.
Right.
And that was killing them. Because when they, you know, they, you hit it on the nose with the Koch brothers. The percentage of taxes that the working person pays at the low end is if those guys were paying proportionally the same amount of taxes, but they have a million.
Right, but see, that's the concept of progressive taxation, and yeah. And Corinne Brown in the clip I ran earlier. Referenced it as well. To those to whom much has been given, much is expected.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you know, the Koch brothers, you know, Dick and Dick.
Yeah.
It's ever so much more convenient just to say Dick and Dick.
Well, you got it right. You got it right.
They want to hold this country hostage, because see. They would nod their filthy little heads at what you just said, Bill, and say, you're right. Working people are overtaxed. But then they would add on a corollary. They'd say working people are overtaxed and working people's taxes should be lowered. But then they say, and so should ours.
Ours, yes. Yeah.
But that fails, you know, that fails to take in the essentially, unless it's on a progressive scale, that fails to take into account the essentially regressive nature of all taxation. If I mean, you know, these libertarian asshats with their flat tax, and frankly, you know, I mean, there's a reason I am the way I am, Bill. My mother would no sooner have taken a swallow of whiskey than she would a swallow of lye. Okay. Just didn't care much. I mean, she was openly hostile to booze, and didn't and beer and wine was in the general category as well.
Oh yeah.
But my mother, and in 1972 when she contracted breast cancer, she quit smoking.
Yeah.
And in later years, whenever and in Alabama this was especially true, whenever they would want to run up the liquor tax. Or the beer tax, or the wine tax, or the cigarette tax.
Oh, everybody comes out and votes, yeah.
Well, no. They did it. I mean, they did it because, you know, the people that affected most had the least political clout. But my mother would look up and say, and it was really fun when she said it to some of the ladies of her Sunday school class. She'd say, you know what? I'm going to have to start drinking and smoking a whole lot. What? Well, yeah, this state government seems to think that the only way to bring in revenue is to tax cigarettes and beer. Well, I was raised to be a good citizen and to believe that we all were in this together, so I reckon I'm going to have to start smoking and drinking so I can play my part.
Well, that's where the real weakness is, Bob, because most people in this country do not think that way. We're not all in this together until the Depression hits. And
then it's questionable.
Yeah. And then you still sometimes wonder. Because there's somebody with a hustle going that'll figure out a way to hustle money. I have bad attitudes sometimes. I see it. I mean, I see it in the groups of musicians that are behind me. Well, we love what we do so much that we'll do it for free. Well, do it for free, all right, but don't. While you're doing it, don't make some other guy a lot of money.
Yeah, because that's the thing. They're not doing it for free. If somebody's standing at the door,
yeah.
and collecting, you know, ice cold cash, then you're not working for free. You're working for less than free.
Yeah.
Because somebody else is still making the money.
I thought about that when he was talking, the young man. Who was it?
That's Dr. John.
Dr. John, man, he's on the money. I mean, he's on the right scent with that.
Well, you both have formed a mutual admiration society because he thinks the world of you.
Well, he's right there. I mean, I can only compare in cold, hard words and truth what has happened before and how this I mean, how come the party that fought ostensibly for the freedom of people is now the big money party?
You talking about the Republicans?
You got it.
Well, see, that's...
Theoretically, I mean. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, it's not even theoretically, because you have to understand that from its very inception, the Republican Party was a cobbled-together party.
Yeah.
And it consisted of abolitionists and know-nothings.
Yeah.
And a significant cadre of people who felt like business was not being given a square deal. Abraham Lincoln got his ass handed to him in Illinois running for the legislature because he wanted to do a bunch of, he voted for a bunch of infrastructure improvements. And then the economy turned sour, and the business interests blamed Lincoln for trying to bankrupt them for government giveaway projects. I mean, there's a story I haven't gotten to, and it's kind of a halfway, well, it's silly enough that it can qualify for Friday, but Rand Paul sat down for an interview, that libertarian ophthalmologist.
Yes, sir.
Sat down for an interview and explained that he deeply respects Abraham Lincoln as one of our greatest presidents. And I read that, and I just hollered, bullshit, he said to Robin, and he turned and walked away.
Yeah.
Because Abraham Lincoln financed... I mean, do you understand? Sorry, don't mean to say that. Abraham Lincoln and his Treasury Secretary, Salmon P. Chase, financed the Civil War on what a libertarian like Rand Paul would call phony debt. Because basically, they sold paper to the New York and New England banking and Chicago banking interests in order to come up with the money to pay for the war. They went deeply in hock. They went into serious deficit spending in order to win the war. And that's how they won the war. I mean, the war wasn't just fought at Antietam. It was fought in boardrooms, and it was fought among people who were deciding whether or not to buy all the bond paper that the government was issuing. So, and I've talked about all that Victorian federal architecture that adorns Capitol Hill now. There was a massive building boom in Washington, D.C. on Capitol Hill in the years immediately following the Civil War. D.C. was absolutely transformed because the government had discovered debt, and I mean there were so many feet, so many trotters in the trough that you couldn't imagine there were that many hogs.
Yeah.
And so that is when the Republican Party became the Republican Party that we know today, because the abolitionist core that is credited with wanting to free the slaves was never more than I doubt if it was even a plurality, Bill.
Hmm.
But it was noisy enough that it dragged the rest of them along, because the rest of them, what Dr. John was talking about that reasoned self-interest,
yeah,
where you're always looking to make a profit based on reason. Well, that's all that was a whole bunch of business-minded Republicans who had come out of the old Whig Party. Remember, Lincoln was a Whig,
yeah,
too.
He was a Whig, yeah.
And were following the pipers of the abolitionist movement because there was a buck to be made in slave freedom.
Yeah, that's true. You had a whole bunch of working people to.
Who, you know,
the more bodies you had, the more you could cut the pay.
Right, and immigrants and northbound former slaves fueled the industrial rise of Chicago.
Yes, sir.
And Cleveland.
Cleveland, yes, sir. The
and Akron. And
I saw that here in Cleveland because I went to school in an urban neighborhood, and a lot of these young kids that I was going to school with, the folks that come up for work during the war.
Yeah.
And because every year when you come back to school, some of these kids had gone down to visit grandma, and they presented the school teacher with a big piece of sugar cane.
Yeah.
If they had gone to that part of the world, you know.
Right.
Made me feel like, man, I just, you know, my relatives don't know how to run a farm, you know.
Right, exactly. Hey, Bill, we got to wrap it up.
Go
man,
ahead,
this
man.
Great. Thanks.
Before I forget, I want to say something again about that young Marine, because my father-in-law had been in many places in the Pacific that was not a tourist attraction. Chinian and Saipan and Iwo and places like that. Anyhow, you go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Bill, and you have yourself a good evening.
I'll do what I can.
All right, we'll talk soon, I hope.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Mr. Stress, Bill, calling from Cleveland. That wraps the program up this evening. Hey, thanks. Thanks, Rob. Rob chipped in as well, and we now find ourselves closing the program only $115 from meeting our goal. Thank you very much, Rob. Thank you, Juanita. Thank you, Sal. Thank you, Horst, and thank you, Waggy. It's what keeps things going. I wrote out about $1,000 in bills today alone. Not kidding. That's how this keeps going. Thanks to everybody who makes all this go. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks always to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and yes, acheact.org. Go there and become part of our effort to get the bill introduced in the Senate. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.